Angie has made it easier than ever to connect with skilled professionals to get all your jobs projects done well. If you own a home, you know how much work it can take, whether it's everyday maintenance and repairs or making dream projects a reality. It can be hard just to know where to start, but now all you need to do is Angie that and find a skilled local pro who will deliver the quality and expertise you need. Angie has over 20 years of home service experience, and they've combined it with new tools to simplify the whole process. Bring them your project online or with the Angie app, answer a few questions, and Angie can handle the rest from start to finish or help you compare quotes from multiple pros and connect instantly, which means you can take care of just about any home project in just a few taps. Because when it comes to getting the most out of your home, you can do this when you Angie that. Download the free Angie mobile app today or visit Angie.com. That's ANGI.com.
The following program is a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights and a proud member of the Simply Scary Podcast Network. Visit SimplyScaryPodcast.com to learn more about this and our other weekly storytelling programs. And become a patron today to show your support and get instant access to our extensive archive of downloadable ad-free tales of terror. Thank you for listening and enjoy the show.
Today's episode of Scary Stories Told in the Dark is brought to you by Empty Faces and Audible. Audible has the largest selection of audiobooks on the planet, which lets you fill your fall with more stories, such as Stephen King's Outsider, Joe Hill's Heart-Shaped Box, and Something in the Water by Katherine Stedman. If you're up for adventures of not just the audio variety, but interactive as well, Empty Faces may just become your newest obsession. If you haven't heard of it yet, Empty Faces is a monthly membership that spins dark tales for you to investigate through clues, codes, and ciphers. Each box includes items to aid your investigation, correspondence to interpret, objects to explore, and messages to analyze. Nothing is as it seems. Like a ghost hunter, you've got to look closely at all the materials and think outside the box. I'll be back after tonight's stories to tell you a little bit more about tonight's sponsors, Audible and Empty Faces, both of whom have some exciting offers for those of you in my listening audience, just in time for the spooky season. Until then, stay tuned. The show is about to begin.
Good evening. I'm storyteller Otis Gyre, and I ain't your grandfather. From where I'm from, we don't do bedtime stories. And if that's what you were expecting, you're in the wrong place. If it's terrifying tales you're after, well then, I've got just the thing. Get comfortable, settle in, turn off the lights, if you dare. Your night is about to get a whole lot darker. Who needs sleep anyway?
Good evening. You're listening to Scary Stories Told in the Dark. Welcome to Season 2. Episode 17, I'm your host, Otis Gyre. In tonight's episode, I'll be performing 5 stories for you about eerie encounters, terror-stricken towns, paranormal packs, vengeful anniversaries, and infernal forerunners. You're listening to the standard edition of tonight's program. If you'd like to show your support and enjoy an extended version of this and other episodes with twice the terror, visit SimplyScaryPodcast.com and click Patrons in the upper menu to sign up today. And thank you for your support. It's time to get started, so lock your doors, turn the lights down low, and settle in.
The show is about to begin.
Our first tale of terror this evening, from an author who prefers to go only by the moniker Stupid Dial-Up, is entitled The Shadows Between Houses. Last night around 1 a.m., my wife and small child walked to my car after a night at my brother-in-law's house. He lives in a sketchy suburban neighborhood, so we are always conscious of our surroundings. As I was getting ready to sit in the driver's seat, I noticed a young man staring at me with determined eyes. I stared back and nodded, but he just stood there staring back at me. Made me uncomfortable. My fatherly instincts kicked in and I squared my shoulders up to the man to give off my best fake, "You want a piece of me?" bravado. As I did, the man raised his hand and pointed at me as though to threaten me, then took off, running faster than I've ever seen another person run. Quite satisfied with my overt display of masculinity, I felt it was safe to sit in the car and proceeded to drive home, but not before cutting it too close and hitting my own mailbox. I took off anyway, thinking I'd offer an explanation once I got home. We had to make a stop at the store for some milk, snacks, and other stuff. My wife went into the store while I stayed with my young daughter in the SUV. When she came back, I popped the rear trunk door so she could load the groceries. After closing it, she got back into the truck, and I started to back out of the parking lot. That's when I noticed that there were handprints on the back window. Agitated, I asked her why she would close the trunk door by touching the windows. She snapped back that she hadn't. We both turned around and noticed that the prints appeared to be belonging to someone with long, thin fingers who had tried looking through the back window of the car and dragged their hands across the window. We inspected the other windows and noticed that the rear driver's seat windows had the same dragging handprint. I called my brother-in-law immediately and let him know that the man I had seen across the street must have been looking into my car. I figured that would explain why he was staring at me so intensely. My brother-in-law said he would take a look out the window and give the cops a call and ask them to patrol the area. My family and I were all pretty exhausted, so we shut off our phones and went straight to bed. This morning, both my wife and I had over 30 missed calls, all from my brother-in-law's wife. I called her back and she was hysterical. I figured that their cars must have been broken into or vandalized. Guilt immediately filled my chest. Instantly, I knew I shouldn't have stared down the stranger like I had. It must have been payback, I thought to myself. Then she started rambling about something being torn to pieces. Apparently, it was her neighbor's teenage daughter. Her body was found right on the side of my in-law's house, in between his and the victim's homes. The poor girl apparently snuck out of her house to go out and was trying to re-enter when someone, or something, grabbed her and mauled her to death. She'd been disemboweled and had two of her limbs ripped from her body. As of now, her right hand is yet to be recovered. My stomach dropped at the news. The stranger that I thought was staring me down wasn't. He had been looking past me, petrified into the shadows at whatever was killing that young lady. He wasn't pointing at me. He was pointing at someone behind us, pointing at it. The cops just left my home moments ago. They were trying to get information on the man I saw. Apparently, they think he is a possible witness or suspect or both. I assured them that I didn't think he was the killer based on my experience with him, but they still wanted to do their due diligence. The detectives also decided to get prints and measurements of the handprints off my vehicle windows. Due to the long, slender nature of the marks left behind, they do not believe them to be the killers, but rather the victims. As if the fact that this maniac, this thing, dragged that dead girl's hand across my vehicle as he was stalking up behind me isn't enough to haunt me forever. I've also discovered that my license plate was torn off my bumper. Looks like I didn't hit that mailbox after all.
Angie has made it easier than ever to connect with skilled professionals to get all your jobs projects done well. If you own a home, you know how much work it can take, whether it's everyday maintenance and repairs or making dream projects a reality. It can be hard just to know where to start, but now all you need to do is Angie that and find a skilled local pro who will deliver the quality and expertise you need. Angie has over 20 years of home service experience, and they've combined it with new tools to simplify the whole process. Bring them your project online or with the Angie app, answer a few questions, and Angie can handle the rest from start to finish or help you compare quotes from multiple pros and connect instantly, which means you can take care of just about any home project in just a few taps. Because when it comes to getting the most out of your home, you can do this when you Angie that. Download the free Angie mobile app today or visit Angie.com. That's ANGI.com.
I hope you enjoyed The Shadows Between Houses by author Stupid Dial-Up. The story just goes to show that things aren't always as they seem. Sometimes, as it turns out, they're much, much worse than you can imagine. Speaking of things that aren't what they seem, up next we've got a tale from author Joe Terrell about a town that's been far more than cursed. But first, I'd like to tell you a bit more about one of today's sponsors, Empty Faces, and what makes them so unique.
You see, Empty Faces is my newest obsession. You become a character inside this story and try to stop an unspeakable evil. Like you're a detective or a paranormal investigator. It's interactive, and man, is it detailed. It feels real. Even the UPS driver got a little freaked out. It's a monthly subscription, so each month, more clues, items, and correspondence are delivered to you, which build up to a thrilling conclusion. It's like a TV show that you can touch. My kit this month, for example, contained a bunch of cool props, including real sage, written clues, and a protective pendant. It's all so lifelike, my cats won't even go near it. Imagine that. You can do Empty Faces with friends for a game night, or the best part yet, you can join their online community to swap theories and ideas with people just like you. You've just got to try this. It's an amazing feature. Empty Faces also has online resources to help keep you on track, and where you can find helpful hints. A word of warning. This service is not for the faint of heart. It's scary. It's creepy. But it's also a lot of fun. More people are joining every day, so get in early. They only accept 200 new members a day, so visit EmptyFaces.com today and get started. As a reminder, my listeners will all get 10% off their first box with the promo code TOLD. Once more, that code is TOLD, spelled T-O-L-D. So what are you waiting for? Visit EmptyFaces.com today and find out if you've got what it takes to stop the evil. Thanks for your support of this show and our sponsor. Now, without further ado, we've got another terrifying tale for you, so grab your safety blanket and snuggle up. Things are about to get spooky.
Our second story this evening is entitled The Strange Case of Edmundson, Kentucky by author Joe Terrell. On October 16th, 1962, every man, woman, and child disappeared from the town of Edmundson, Kentucky. The date is relatively easy to pin down. The day before, October 15th, a traveling salesman named Arnold Johnson passed through the small town in an unsuccessful attempt to sell an exciting new product, the bagless vacuum cleaner. During an interview with authorities afterwards, Johnson said he noticed nothing unusual about Edmondson in the day before the disappearances. He did, however, remark that none of the housewives he spoke with during his brief stay seemed remotely interested in his product, something he found slightly surprising compared to the responses he typically received when demonstrating the vacuum cleaner to similarly sized towns. "Not only did I not sell a single vacuum cleaner, not even one wanted to see the product in action," he said during the interview. "If you could get in the door and show the women what the vacuum could do, you were guaranteed a sale." Johnson chalked up his failure to the apprehension related to the Cuban Missile Crisis, which had begun a day before and had been dominating the airwaves. "It's hard to sell a vacuum cleaner when your audience thinks there's a possibility there'll be radioactive dust by the end of the week," he said. Johnson left the town of Edmondson the evening of October 15th. The next town on his sales route, Clement, was 80 miles away. He drove all night and didn't think about Edmondson until investigators from the Federal Bureau of Investigation knocked on his door 2 weeks later. During the early morning hours of October 17th, Randall Pierce, a farmer who sold his produce to the only grocer in Edmondson, drove into town to discover empty streets and closed storefronts. "It was eerie," Pierce told the county newspaper later. "Usually at 7 in the morning, that little town was bustling. I thought I had maybe driven up during a holiday." Pierce lived with his wife and 3 children on a farm 15 miles outside of Edmondson. Like most families farming in the early 1960s, Pierce's wife homeschooled their children when they weren't helping their father tend the farm. "But I couldn't think of any holiday that would close up the town in the middle of October, so I started getting a little spooked," Pierce said. "I knocked on the doors of a few houses and didn't get a response from any of them. Around 8 o'clock, I realized there wasn't a single soul in Edmondson." Shaken and a little disoriented, Pierce returned home to his wife and children. He told them what he had seen, or not seen, in Edmondson, and with nationalistic fears of a communist invasion running rampant, his wife convinced him to drive to Clement and report what he had seen to the authorities. The Pierce family had no phone at their farm. Pierce arrived in Clement shortly after noon and immediately pulled into the parking lot of the local police department. He told the authorities what he had witnessed in Edmondson. Initially, as Pierce tells it, his story was met with disbelief and ridicule, but after multiple calls to Edmondson's police chief went unanswered, Clement's sheriff, Jonathan Ambrose, gathered a group of men and traveled to Edmondson to investigate Pierce's claims. Sheriff Ambrose died of lung cancer in 1968. However, in spite of being a veteran of both World War II and the Korean War, on his deathbed, Ambrose said that his visit to Edmondson on October 17th was the most disturbing and haunting experience of my entire life, and thinking about the events of that day would still turn the blood in his veins to ice. According to the most recent census, 236 individuals lived in Edmondson in 1960. It was a small town nestled between the hills of western Kentucky, named after a captain who was killed during the Battle of 1812. Edmondson was populated primarily by the ancestors who founded the town in 1825. Edmondson had one public school, a grocery store, a bank, Wells Fargo, a hospital clinic, 2 churches, Baptist and Methodist, and a post office. Most of the men worked small farms, like Pierce, or ran a trade. Edmondson, like most small communities in rural areas, was self-sufficient and self-sustaining. Every 2 weeks, the grocery store would be restocked, and the post office would deliver mail every Tuesday. For entertainment, residents of Edmondson would have to visit Clement or another nearby town. On October 17, 1962, Clement Sheriff Ambrose, two deputies, and the Clement primary physician piled into a squad car and followed country farmer Randall Pierce back into Edmondson. Ambrose carried his service special, an M1911A1 45 ACP, and ordered his deputies to bring their shotguns for running 12-gauge pump actions. The physician, Alan Cathy, was brought along in case a mass casualty event had taken place. Before he died in 1968, Ambrose recounted the events of October 17th to his older son, who transcribed his father's testimony and published it in a men's magazine to little fanfare in 1974. It was a two-hour drive from Clement to Edmondson, and we all expected to show up in that little town and find nothing wrong except for maybe a drunk police chief who overslept his shift, Ambrose said. However, I couldn't deny the fact that a palatable tension was present in the squad car. My two deputies kept fidgeting with their shotguns, and Cathy wouldn't stop rummaging through his physician's bag. It was the same type of behavior that I observed among soldiers before we were set to launch a big assault. Upon arriving in Edmondson, they immediately realized something was, in fact, very wrong. Pierce and Ambrose parked their cars in front of the grocery store along the main street. It was just as Pierce had described it. The town seemed completely devoid of life. Ambrose, who personally knew Edmondson's police chief and where he lived, decided they should check out his home first. The five men set out on foot into the residential neighborhood. All the men were struck by the silence. It was then that one of the deputies realized that not only were there no people in town, there were no animals to speak of. Yards, with fences that were clearly meant to keep dogs in, were noticeably empty. The men arrived at the police chief's home to find the front door unlocked. Ambrose, with his gun drawn, entered the house first and was followed by his two shotgun-toting deputies. "I don't know what we were expecting to find," Ambrose said. "I honestly thought we'd find a body. Maybe poisonous gas had leaked from the ground at some point during the night and killed off the whole town. But I think what we found was worse." The police chief's house was empty, and the bed was made up in the bedroom, and the fridge still contained bottles of fresh milk. The men were baffled. Maybe, they thought, the townspeople had left to attend a large community picnic. But as the hours dragged on and the search continued, that possibility grew less likely. We searched six other houses in the neighborhood after we canvassed the police chief's house, Ambrose said. It was always the same story. The house seemed fine, no sign of forced entry, unlocked doors, and no occupants. However, a few similarities began to make themselves apparent as the men made their way from house to house. For one, there was no luggage to be found anywhere in the homes, and it appeared as if a majority of the clothing was missing from drawers and wardrobes. Pierce, the farmer, also noticed that much of the food left in the pantries and refrigerators were perishable. There were no canned goods. Ambrose, who had just finished reading C.S. Lewis's The Great Divorce, remembered thinking, "It's as if the whole town just packed up their belongings and boarded a bus to heaven." Some of the discoveries were less benign. In the backyard of one home, the men discovered a dead Labrador retriever. One of the deputies stumbled across the animal and thought at first it was sleeping. The dog was wearing a collar and was loosely chained to a tree in the backyard. It was the first animal they'd seen in Edmondson since arriving 2 hours earlier. While the men searched the home, Cathy, the physician, performed an ad hoc autopsy on the animal. Rigor mortis had only recently set in, indicating the dog had not been dead for more than a day. Additionally, Cathy found raw hamburger meat in the animal's stomach, hamburger meat that had been peppered with small white pills. The dog had been poisoned. In another home, they found the words Revelation 9:1 scrawled on a bathroom mirror in light pink lipstick. The men were unfamiliar with the Bible verse and this led to the next disquieting discovery. They could not find a single Bible in the town. Edmondson had two churches, and it can be deduced that a majority of the township probably attended one or the other. In the early 1960s, a vast majority of Americans considered themselves Christian, and even those who wouldn't consider themselves very devoted could be expected to at least own a Bible. However, Ambrose and his men couldn't locate a Bible in any of the homes they searched. When they inspected both churches, they found only hymnals or books of common prayer in the pews. Except for the poisoned dog during their 3-hour search of Edmondson, they found no signs of violence or struggle. Every home's interior looked impeccable, and running water and electricity appeared to be in working order. Ambrose was reminded of the model communities the U.S. Army had built in New Mexico to test the destructive power of the atomic bomb. As the sun began to slip beneath the trees, and the men's shadows grew longer and dimmer, Ambrose detected another palpable sense of urgency brewing among members of the group. It was obvious the men didn't want to remain in Edmondson after sundown. Ambrose said, "And I felt it too. I somehow sensed that if we stayed in Edmondson overnight, there'd be another group of men from Clement trying to find us the next afternoon. And I don't think they'd find us." Before twilight ended, the men loaded up in their cars, the two deputies, Kathy and Ambrose, in a squad car and Pierce in his truck, and left Edmondson. Even though they knew the town was empty, each man reported a creeping sensation that they were being watched from the darkened windows of the homes they passed on their way out of town. We didn't talk much about the ride back to Clement, and I'd be lying if I said I was driving with any regard toward the speed limit, Ambrose said. We had to get out of there. At that point, I was convinced we had stumbled across ground zero of some new communist weapon system. Something that could vaporize the inhabitants of an entire town without causing any collateral damage. But even then I knew that the story didn't completely add up. After the men arrived back in Clement, they agreed that Ambrose would contact the federal government in the morning. None of the men expressed any interest in returning to Edmondson. That night, Ambrose retrieved his family Bible from their study and flipped to Revelation 9:1. And the fifth angel sounded, "And I saw a star fall from heaven unto the earth, and to him was given the key to the bottomless pit." "I didn't know what to make of that," Ambrose said. The next morning, Ambrose reported what he had seen in Edmondson to the governing authorities in Frankfurt. Things began moving very quickly after that. While the rest of the world was transfixed by the escalating tensions between Cuba and the United States, the FBI sent an investigative team to investigate the disappearances at Edmondson. Fearing a communist plot, or, as Ambrose had suspected, the use of a powerful new weapon, the FBI shut down access to Edmondson on October 19, 1962. The strange case of Edmondson made its way into a few local papers, but it was the story that always buried behind pages of international news. Because much of the town's inhabitants were ancestors of the people who founded the town, there weren't too many relatives inquiring about the status of their loved ones. The roads that passed through Edmondson, there were very few, were rerouted around the town. The FBI finished their investigation in 1967, but by then no one really cared about Edmondson anymore. In between the town's disappearances in 1962 and the FBI's final report on the incident, the nation's attention had been distracted by a number of earth-shattering events: the assassination of President Kennedy, the burgeoning civil rights movement, and the U.S.'s involvement in Vietnam. Unfortunately, the result of the FBI investigation was sealed and deemed confidential. As the decades progressed, nature began to overtake Edmondson, Kentucky. No attempt was made to rebuild or resettle the town. Edmondson soon became a little-known historical footnote in Kentucky's history. While many of the structures collapsed due to exposure, a handful of homes and one of the churches remained standing, enshrouded by thick vines and a thriving deer population. In 2002, the official report from the FBI was made public after a local historian placed a Freedom of Information request. Dennis Miller, president and sole member of the Edmondson Historical Society, learned the FBI officially declared the reason for the town's spontaneous abandonment as fears related to the possibility of nuclear annihilation. An unexplained atmospheric phenomenon led to a panic-induced dispersal of the town. Of course, that reasoning was BS, Miller said. The report doesn't even mention the fact that none of the townspeople had ever been accounted for. There were no reports of atmospheric phenomenon by anyone in the area. However, by then, a new theory had emerged regarding the fate of the Edmondson's inhabitants. A theory that began circulating after two self-proclaimed backyard adventurers stumbled upon a hatch in the basement of the abandoned First Baptist Church of Edmondson. The Mammoth Cave in Kentucky is the world's largest known cave system. At least 400 miles have been mapped, and some scientists estimate there could be another 600 miles that are unexplored and have never been seen by human eyes. As of 2016, 26 entrances into the cave system have been discovered. And in 1981, one of those entrances was discovered in the ruins of Edmondson, Kentucky. During the late 1970s, the abandoned ruins of Edmondson attained a cult status among backpackers and hitchhikers in the area. With the roads leading to Edmondson in disrepair, getting to the abandoned town is extremely difficult. But every year, intrepid amateur adventurers and curious locals would make the trek to one of the country's greatest but forgotten unsolved mysteries. 19 years after the disappearances, hikers Emilio Stevens and Julie Page parked their vehicles 30 miles outside the edges of the forest that surrounds the abandoned township and began their trek to Edmondson. "We'd visited Edmondson 2 years before that day," Stevens said to Scientific Journal afterwards. "It's creepy as hell. It takes about a day and a half to reach the town from the trailhead, and when you get there, you really don't feel like sticking around. Most hikers pass through it or camp overnight on the outskirts. That November, Julie and I planned on staying overnight in the church. I think it was more about testing our nerves than anything else." The church Stevens is talking about is the First Baptist Church of Edmondson. It's the largest structure still standing in the town. The grocery store and Methodist church collapsed in the late 1960s. "We arrived in Edmondson around nightfall on the second day," Stevens said. "Julie wasn't feeling too hot, and it was beginning to sprinkle. We set out the tent in the center of the church and prepared for our night. I could tell it was going to be a miserable night. The roof of the church leaked, and a lot of the pews had been destroyed by vandals and raccoons." As they settled in for the night, Stevens and Page both couldn't shake a creeping sense of dread. Even though they had hiked into Edmondson before, they both felt unprepared for the degree of uneasiness they were experiencing. Around midnight, however, exhaustion got the better of the two of them, and they fell asleep. 2 hours later, Stevens awoke to a loud cracking sound. "At first I thought it was thunder, but then the floor slanted and we were falling," Stevens said. "There's nothing more disorienting than waking up in a tent and experiencing the sensation of free fall." The floor of the church had collapsed in the middle of the night, flinging Stevens and Page into an as-of-yet-undiscovered basement. Luckily, both Stevens and Page survived the fall without any serious injury. "We were both pretty shaken and, frankly, a little banged up," Stevens said. "But in all the time we had spent in and around Edmondson, we had never heard of a basement in the Baptist church. We knew we had found something no one else knew about." Armed with only their flashlights, Stevens and Page set exploring the decrepit basement. The room, hidden beneath the floorboards of the church, was small and appeared to have been carved into the bedrock beneath the building's foundation. Stevens said there wasn't much to see. It looked as if the room had been used to store extra tables and chairs, presumably for after-church socials. But then they found a hatch. "Page found it in the far corner of the basement," Stevens said. "It was set flush against the floor of the basement, and it was made of four thick wood planks and the hinges had been bolted onto the bedrock on the left side. The door had one of those old-fashioned drop-ring handles. Stevens gripped a hold of the drop-ring handle and, after several tries, wrenched the hatch open. The square of darkness stared back up at him. Page activated and dropped a glow stick into the shaft. The pale green glow of the stick stopped about 5 feet from the mouth of the hatch. "Well, we had to go down there," Stevens said. "It was probably 3 in the morning, and we were sure as hell weren't going back to sleep." Stevens tied a climbing rope to his back pantaloupe and dropped down through the hatch. Page stayed above and metered out the rope as Stevens progressed into the darkness. At the bottom of the shaft, a passageway opened up to my left, pointing westward. It was obvious by then that I was traveling through a cave tunnel, and that it was not man-made, Stevens said. Eventually, the tunnel tightened, and Stevens found himself crawling on his hands and knees. The roof of the passageway scratched his back, and his hands began to get rubbed raw by the cave's rough floor. "I'm not claustrophobic, but it started getting pretty tight," Stevens said. "I began to worry about not being able to turn around and get back to the hatch. But I started to hear something coming from up ahead of me. I should have been freaked out, but at that point, I figured I had gone too far to bail out." After 15 minutes of crawling, Stevens was straining to push his shoulders through the ever-tightening passageway, but the eerie noises emanating from above drove him deeper into the cave. However, his adventure came to an abrupt end. "The passageway ended at a pile of rocks," Stevens said. "Each rock looked to be about the size of my head, and they completely blocked any further spelunking. I could hear the noises clearly now, could even distinguish words and phrases, but my journey was done. However, right before the passageway terminated at the cave-in, Stevens found a couple of objects. He put them in his jacket and began backing out. It took him 30 minutes to back up out of the tight passageway. When he made it up out of the shaft and back into the church's basement to a relieved Page, he took out the objects and inspected them. I found a pair of eyeglasses, like old-fashioned reader's glasses, and a woman's shoe with the heel missing," Stevens said. "Didn't mean anything to us at the time." Stevens and Page hiked out of Edmondson early the next morning, battered and spooked. When they reached their car, they immediately headed into Mammoth National Park and reported what they had found to a park ranger. In the investigation that followed, it was determined that Stevens and Page had discovered an entrance into an unmapped portion of the Mammoth Cave system. Unfortunately, geologists determined that the cave-in that had stopped Stevens' progress was at least 100 feet thick. Unless they used explosives, there was no way to investigate further. However, it was the discovery of the cave entrance, coupled with the objects that Stevens found, that held disturbing implications for an unsolved mystery of the disappearances in Edmondson 20 years prior. Historians dated the eyeglasses and the woman's shoe to the late '50s and early '60s. Most historians and geological experts are now in near unanimous agreement about what happened to the inhabitants of Edmondson, Kentucky, in 1962. Driven by fears of a first strike by Cuba during the missile crisis and religious fanaticism, the people of Edmondson sought refuge in a secret labyrinth cave system underneath their town. Unfortunately, a cave-in, perhaps triggered by their panicked influx through the tight passageways, trapped every man, woman, and child deep underground. It's deeply unsettling when you realize that at the same time, Sheriff Ambrose and his men were exploring the town, with everyone they were searching for was probably about 400 feet underneath their feet, said Sam Tso, a ranger at Mammoth National Park. If they had fresh water and food, and if the cave had a clean air supply, some experts believe that the people of Edmondson could have survived for at least 6 months underground. I reckon it's a pretty good theory, Stevens said, but it still didn't explain what I heard that night. The reason I dropped down through that hatch and crawled on my hands and knees for 15 minutes. It doesn't explain the singing I heard. While I was crawling down there, I clearly heard voices singing the hymn, "Come, Thou Fount." Dennis Miller started the Edmondson Historical Society in 2001 to raise awareness about the town and the mystery surrounding it. He was 12 years old. "It really is a 20th century Roanoke," Miller said, referencing the New England colony that disappeared in 1590. "And there's no reason why we shouldn't be able to figure out what happened." Miller lives in Clement, and on his days when he's not researching Edmondson, he runs a small pawn shop. Many people consider Miller's fascination with Edmondson to border on an obsession, but when they learn about Miller's personal history with the area, it begins to make sense. During a family camping trip in 1997, Miller's father and mother went missing after making camp in the wilderness 3 miles north of Edmondson. Miller, who was 7 at the time, was with them when they disappeared. "We camped often, and we used a big tent for the three of us," Miller said. "That night, we went to bed around 9 after cooking hot dogs. I woke up around 1 in the morning and realized my parents weren't in the tent anymore, and the front flap was open." Miller spent 2 days alone in the woods, never straying far from the campsite in case his parents came back. After sustaining on hot dog buns and marshmallows, he was discovered by another set of campers passing through the area. After searching the area for 2 weeks, the police officially concluded that I had been abandoned in the woods by my parents, Miller said. "But that's not true. My parents loved me, I never doubted that. And if they had abandoned me, why didn't they hike to their car? It was found untouched at the trailhead." After the investigation closed, Miller spent the next decade of his life in and out of the foster care system. Driven by a desire to protect his parents' reputation and validate their love for him, Miller began reviewing historical records in libraries and did a sweep of the police records in the surrounding areas. Some might accuse Miller of attempting to connect unrelated dots, but some of his data and findings are shocking, to say the least. For example, the three counties that border the location of Edmondson have a missing persons rate 17 times higher than similarly sized counties in the United States. "It's an area we sometimes refer to as the Kentucky Triangle," said FBI agent Brittany Hooper, head of the state's Missing Persons Division. "For some reason, a lot of people seem to disappear in those counties." Some of the disappearances can be attributed to caving accidents, the vast swaths of unmapped wilderness, and the recent bloom of meth operations in rural areas. Also, Stevens wasn't the first person to report hearing strange voices and singing in and around the Mammoth Cave systems. Some people consider Mammoth National Park to be the most haunted national park in the United States. There have been dozens of accounts of people hearing strange noises in the woods and caves since the 1970s, as well as sightings of a tall, humanoid-like creature called the Black Demon, according to unrelated local lore. Geologists and historians dismiss many of these accounts. After Stevens told authorities he'd been following the voices of singing as he made his way through the passageways, expert cavers were quick to point out that even if he had heard people singing, it could not have come from behind the caved-in rocks. The cave-in was too thick for sound to penetrate. Also, because Mammoth National Park sits atop the Mammoth Cave system, it's not unreasonable to assume that a lot of the cave's strange noises and voices are the result of sound bouncing and echoing throughout the caverns. Caves are, after all, notorious for their disorienting acoustics. But Miller has a different theory. A theory as macabre as it would be revelatory if it turned out to be true. "I think some of the trapped people of Edmondson are still alive," Miller said. "I think they're down there in an unmapped portion of the cave system, and that they've chosen to stay below. It's been about 70 years since they went in, which means the first generation has probably mostly died off, and there's an entire second or third generation that only knows life underground. As for the disappearances, Miller has an answer for that as well. I think they found other exits, and every now and then they come out and take people. Hikers, drifters, campers, and locals, Miller said. I think that's what's happened to my parents, and it's been happening years before they were taken, and it continues today. On his off days, you can find Miller searching the forests around Edmondson and the outskirts of Mammoth National Park for additional entrances into the Mammoth Cave system. He carries a GPS locator, rappelling gear, multiple flashlights, and a Colt 45 automatic pistol. For some reason, they don't want to be seen by us, Miller said. I don't know what they do with the people they take, but I know what it takes to maintain an underground society. It requires food and a fresh gene pool. I don't like thinking about what that meant for my mom and dad, but even if the truth is ugly, at least I'll know. And I'll be able to do something about it. In spite of being armed, as soon as the sun begins to slink behind the trees, Miller makes sure to abandon his search and head back to his vehicle. You'll never find me spending the night in those woods again, Miller said. I hope you enjoyed The Strange Case of Edmondson, Kentucky by author Joe Terrell. And you thought you had it bad when someone forgets your name? Oh, yeah. Up next, we've got an emotional roller coaster of a tale from an anonymous author about the importance of promises in both life and death. But first, I'd like to tell you a bit more about this episode's second sponsor, Audible. Audible has the largest selection of audiobooks on the planet, which lets you fill your fall with more stories like It, The Shining, The Dark Tower series from Stephen King, The Complete Blackwater Saga from Michael McDowell, and Batman, the latest, long-awaited novel from Reddit No Sleep author Dathan Auerbach, writer of the infamous Pen Pal series. The classics are there, too, with collections of tales from H.P. Lovecraft, Richard Matheson, Bram Stoker, and many, many more. As if all of this wasn't awesome enough as it is, they've also introduced Audible Originals, a new member benefit. Audible members now get more, 2 Audible Originals and 1 audiobook every month. What are Audible Originals, you may ask? Well, let me tell you. Audible Originals are exclusive audio titles created by celebrated storytellers from worlds as diverse as theater, journalism, literature, and more. And every month, Audible members get 1 credit good for any audiobook they choose, plus 2 Audible Originals from a changing selection that they can't get anywhere else. They also get access to audio fitness and health workouts created exclusively for Audible. For my listeners, Audible is now offering 30 days to try Audible free, which includes your choice of any audiobook plus 2 Audible Originals on them. It's a perfect way to discover what millions already have. That listening lets you get more books in your life, because with the free Audible app, you can enjoy them anytime, anywhere. At home, at the gym, while commuting, or doing chores. Plus, your books are yours to keep. With Audible, you can go back and re-listen anytime, even if you cancel your membership. Yeah, you heard that right. You'll get your first audiobook free and get the chance to select 2 titles from a curated list of Audible Originals when you try Audible for 30 days. Visit audible.com/told or text told to 500500. Again, that URL is Audible, spelled audible.com/told, spelled T-O-L-D, or text the word told, T-O-L-D, to 500500. So why not join the millions enjoying the unmatched selection of audiobooks Audible has to offer and sign up today? With their extensive library of horror, sci-fi, and supernatural titles, In my backlog of terrifying tales, you'll never run out of nightmare fuel. Thanks for all your support of this show and of Audible.
Now, without further ado,
we've got another terrifying tale for you. So grab your safety blanket and snuggle up. We've only just begun. Our third tale tonight comes to us courtesy of an anonymous author. I present to you Promises. I was one of those frail, sickly children for the vast majority of my early years. I was constantly being shuffled from physician to physician, with one ailment or another, asthma, perpetual tonsillitis, severe allergies to everything. You name it, I dealt with it at one point or another growing up. This meant that I spent a great deal of my formative years at home, in bed, miserably sick and more than a bit morose. There was an upside to this, however. My father would often take time out of work to sit in my bedroom and read to me. Some of my fondest memories as a child involved my father sitting in a chair next to my bed with one science fiction novel or another spread across his lap. I can't count how many days were spent in such a fashion. I look back on it now and can't help but smile when I picture that large man with his bushy beard reading those thick novels to take my mind away from whatever was ailing me at the time. I was fortunate to come from a very loving home. My mother and father were extremely doting and focused all of their collective time and energy on raising their only son. I was particularly close to my father. We've all heard the old adage about daddy's girls and mama's boys, but that simply wasn't the case in my experience. Of course, every boy views his father as some larger-than-life, lantern-jawed superhero, and I was no exception. My father was an enormous man, maybe 6'2" and well over 250 pounds. He was an intimidating figure. My childhood friends would often remark on just how large he was. He had very intense grayish-blue eyes, brown hair that was slowly receding, and a thick red beard. But as intimidating as he may have appeared, his demeanor, especially towards me, was always so calm and relaxed. He never once raised his voice within earshot, nor did I ever witness him use that great bulk of his to bully or intimidate. He was a kind soul, and spent all of his time letting his only son know just how much he was loved. He'd spend hours of his evenings after work in my room, sitting on the floor playing with my toys. I can't help but chuckle when I picture that large man sitting cross-legged on the floor with whatever superhero or mutant turtle I was interested in at that point. He even kept a small journal of all the funny things I'd say and do, and with some of his own musings, remarking on just how quickly I was growing. I recall, years later, when I was a man myself, reading that journal and being moved to tears by how deeply this man loved me. Now, my father was not a particularly religious man. In fact, if I had to peg his beliefs, I'd say he was atheistic now that I have a grasp of such things. This was in direct conflict with how he was raised. He'd grown up in a very small town in North Carolina and was brought up in a very strict Southern Baptist family. He remarked in the journal, just days after my birth, about how he found the Bible to be even more preposterous now that he had a child of his own. In particular, the story of Isaac and Abraham did not sit so well with my father. He couldn't imagine any scenario in which he'd be willing to sacrifice his only son to some voice in his head. He was a very straightforward logic and reason type of guy. In addition to religion, he absolutely abhorred superstitions and myths. He made several comments about being leery of anyone that claimed to believe in aliens or ghost stories. Now, he never made these statements to me directly. He wanted me to come to my own conclusions regarding religion, superstition, and the paranormal. But he did jot down all of these thoughts in that journal of his, with the intention of giving me this book when I became a man myself. Unfortunately, he never did get that opportunity. As you can imagine, his death had a devastating impact on the course of my life. I remember vividly my mother coming into my room with tears and makeup streaming down her face. She cradled me in her arms and, for the longest time, simply rocked back and forth while sobbing silently to herself. Eventually, she pulled herself together enough to tell me that my father's small pickup truck had been struck on his drive home from work. The other vehicle involved was a semi, being driven by a man with too little sleep and too much alcohol in his system. He didn't even know that he'd been involved in an accident until the officer responding to the crash pulled him from the wreckage of his own vehicle. I was in shock. I was beyond consoling and, honestly, I was furious. I was only 5 or 6 when my father passed, and in my mind all I could focus on was the fact that my dad had broken his promise. He would say to me, as he tucked me in at night, that I was his favorite thing in the world and he would always be there to make certain I was safe. It was repeated so often, night after night, that it almost became a mantra of his. But he made that promise, and now he wouldn't be around to keep it. After my father's death, my mother was unable to afford the small 3-bedroom home nestled in the foothills of the mountains that I'd grown up in. We were forced to move to an older, run-down part of town, and needless to say, it was just another factor contributing to the overwhelming sense of loss I was dealing with at the time. I hated the town. I hated the new school that I was required to attend when my health permitted. But most of all, I hated our new home and the empty feeling it seemed to exude without my father's presence. He never lived in that house. Those walls had never heard that big guttural laugh of his, or sat idly by as he read to me during one of my many tilts with sickness. The house was a source of anxiety for me in those days. It was old, built sometime in the 1920s, my mother had told me. It was ancient. It was cold, and everything about it seemed to be in a constant state of disrepair. The white paint was chipping in numerous spots on the exterior. The hardwood floors were warped and pockmarked throughout. Even the grass outside remained a dismal brown year-round. The house only had 2 small bedrooms, a bathroom, a tiny dated kitchen, and a musty little living room that seemed to be an afterthought in the builder's original designs. I loathed that house. The floors creaked as everything settled at night. The windows were so old and grimy that they permitted very little light. My room was situated in the very back of the house and was so small that I had just enough room for my twin bed and a little dresser. We'd been in the house for about 6 weeks when I started noticing some odd things happening, especially at night. I would come home from school to find that my bed, which had been made that morning, was in complete disarray. The clothes in my closet would sometimes be strewn across my room, much to my mother's disapproval, and other small things like doors and windows seemingly opening and closing of their own volition. But the first truly unnerving occurrence that I can recall was just after my mom had tucked me in one night. I was staring at the ceiling, trying to decide if the water stain above my bed resembled a dog or something a bit more equestrian. I was beginning to nod off, catching myself closing my eyelids for a bit longer than was required to blink. My thoughts were slowly spiraling towards something that were closer to dreams when I heard a small scratching sound coming from the foot of my bed. At that time, my bed was nestled in the corner of the room, parallel to the door on one side, and opposite my small closet that was a few feet from the footboard of the bed. I dismissed the sound as one of the many unexplained noises the house emitted at night, and began drifting once more when I heard the noise again. This time it was louder and unmistakable as scratching. It was with a bit more purpose, it seemed. I held my breath, closed my eyes, and focused all my attention on deciphering that sound. This time, when it happened, it was definitely louder and seemed to have a rhythm to it that just couldn't be naturally occurring. It was almost like Morse code, like the scratching was meant to convey some kind of message. I got the feeling that it wasn't trying to say ship in distress, or anything as mundane or typical as that. I can't explain why, but the sound began to make me feel very uneasy, as though it were malevolent in nature. The hair on the back of my neck began to rise without prompting, and I found myself pulling the cover closer and closer to my chin. It would stop, sporadically, and then begin again with more fervor each time, and always that same rhythm, scratch, 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 followed by a short pause, and then scratch, scratch. I was frozen, completely fixated on this noise, but unable to call out to my mother, whose bedroom was on the other side of the wall. My mouth was dry, and I was constantly moving my tongue around, swallowing to force something resembling moisture back into my mouth. Suddenly, the scratching stopped, mid-sequence this time, and was replaced by the rattling of the closet doors. The closet was that old accordion-style sliding type with the wooden slats. I was amazed that the sound hadn't prompted my mother to come in and see why I was out of bed. The rattling became more insistent, violent even, and that's when I rediscovered the ability to scream. I yelled at the capacity my little lungs would permit until my room was flooded with light and I could make up my mother's silhouette in the doorway. "What's wrong, honey? What is it?" Concern evident in my mother's sleepy voice. I sat up in bed, never taking my eyes off the closet. "There's someone in there, Mommy. In the closet." She blinked a few times to clear the remaining fuzziness that sleep offers from her eyes and walked over to the closet. She flung the doors open with a horrid screeching sound, and when it was clear that no boogeyman was immediately apparent, began shuffling the clothes hanging from the rod to show me there was no occupant. "See, sweetheart, there's no one in here. It was just a bad dream." She closed the doors again, crossed the hardwood floor, and arranged herself at the foot of my bed. "It's no surprise that you're having nightmares, son, considering all that's happened recently." She patted my leg, then reached up to smooth my disheveled hair. "I promise you, there's no one in there," she said. I was finally able to peel my attention away from the closet and meet her eyes. "I know there was," I said. "There were some weird scratching noises. Then the door started to shake." She stifled a yawn behind her fist, then patted my cheek as she rose from the edge of my bed. "Just a dream, son. There's no one in there, and there's no one in the house but us. Now, please, try to get some sleep. You have to go to school tomorrow, and you don't want to be nodding off in class." She crossed the room and told me she loved me before she turned my bedroom light back off. I heard her mattress spring sigh as she got back into her bed, and I laid down again myself. I maneuvered myself as close to the wall and headboard as I could imagine, pulled the cover up to my nose and shut my eyes with such force that they squeezed tears down my cheeks. Tried to control my breathing and focus everything my sense of hearing had to offer for that sound. My heart was pounding so loudly in my ears that I barely heard the first scratch when the noise came again. I stopped breathing altogether and waited for the next series of scratches to begin again. The minutes dragged by, but the sound did not come again, and at some point I fell into a rather fitful stage of sleep that was accompanied by nightmares. Over the coming weeks, the sound would come and go. There didn't seem to be any pattern to it at all. There would be several nights in a row with absolutely nothing unusual occurring, and then there would come a night when the scratching would start up as soon as I began to drift off, and last until I screamed for my mother. This became something of a pattern. I wouldn't say I became accustomed to it, but I knew that on those nights when the scratching started, that all I had to do was yell for my mom, and after she came in to take a look around, I'd finally be able to sleep. It had been 3 or 4 nights since the last time I heard the rhythmic scratching. I managed to fall asleep that night without event. Maybe I'd been lulled into some false sense of security, as it had been several nights since the last closet incident. It was about 1 or so in the morning when I awoke with a start. I'd fallen asleep on top of my covers, and as soon as I became aware of being conscious, I wrestled with trying to crawl underneath them. After much effort, I was finally able to get underneath the comfort and security of my sheets when I began to wonder what exactly had stirred me from the throngs of sleep. It was a cloudy night, so the limited amount of light permitted through my bedroom window was at an absolute minimum that night. I controlled my breathing, listening for that ominous sound, and forced my eyes to scan the bedroom. And that's when I saw it. Standing at the foot of my bed, in front of my slowly deteriorating closet doors, was a very large form. It was so dark that I couldn't make out whether this thing, this being, was facing my direction or not. I couldn't move. I couldn't scream. I could barely even draw breath. All of my attention was on that form at the foot of my bed. I couldn't look away. It's as if my eyelids were taped open, and I was forced that look in that direction. The form never moved, never even shifted from foot to foot. It simply stood there, massive and dark, and filling the whole room. There was no scratching sound, no rattling of the doors, just this form standing stoically in the middle of my room. Amazingly, I fell asleep. I can't begin to imagine how that came to be. I just know that one minute I was fixated with every fiber of my being on this figure in my room, and the next minute I'm opening my eyes to sunlight trickling in through my window and birds chirping outside as they went about their daily activities. What's even more amazing is that I didn't awake with that sense of terror that I'd grown accustomed to after a run-in with a scratching sound. I even felt rested for the first time in months. That same thing happened again several times over the next couple of nights. I found myself waking in the middle of the night, only to be confronted by the image of that large, silent form at the foot of my bed. Again, there was no scratching sound or rattling closet doors, just this figure standing there a few feet away. I never worked up the courage to yell for my mother or try to get a closer look at this shadow-like form. I still wasn't even certain if it was facing in my direction on the nights this occurred. I even began to wonder if perhaps this thing standing in my room at night had simply tired of causing a ruckus in my closet and accepted my presence in the house. The next few weeks went by without anything of note occurring. I ate breakfast, went to school, came home, and then went to bed. My health had hit a relative high point during that period of time, and I was attending school on a regular basis for the first time in memory. At some point, I even befriended one of the boys a few houses down and spent my evenings playing video games and the like at his house. I went to bed absolutely exhausted each night and woke the next morning well-rested and looking forward to what the day might hold. I began to discount those terrifying events that occurred in my room in the weeks prior as nothing more than my imagination. My mother had taken on more hours at the furniture factory where she worked to help pay off some of the debt that accrued after my father's death. On the night she worked late, I was to spend my evenings over at my new friend Ryan's house until she returned home. I didn't like to see my mother so tired from all the extra work she was putting in, but I did enjoy getting to hang out with my friend and his rather expansive collection of video games, a luxury my mother couldn't afford. This routine of staying with Ryan's family until my mother got off work lasted for several weeks until my mother had an accident at work. She broke several bones in her right hand and wrist, and wasn't able to work at all for the next few months, let alone pick up extra hours. She was obviously dismayed because just as it seemed our lives had begun to take on the normalcy that everyone expects, some unforeseen event once again caused that pattern to veer off course. She received some pretty heavy-duty pain medication along with a cast on her arm and retired to bed early the night of her accident. I was permitted to watch television after I completed my homework, and then I went to bed myself after my favorite cartoons went off. I'd been in bed for about a half hour, listening to the usual sounds of my mother's snoring from the room next door, when I thought I heard that all-too-familiar scratching sound from my closet. Initially, I tried to ignore it, going so far as to covering my head with my pillows and forcing myself to sleep. After a few minutes, I realized that this wasn't working. The scratching sound never abated and only seemed to increase in tempo as the minutes passed. I was more angry than frightened at this point. It had been many weeks since the last time I had to deal with this, and I'd begun to hope that it had stopped altogether. After a few more minutes, I finally came to the decision that I should open the closet door myself and finally put my mind at ease. It had to be a rat or something. There had to be some explanation, and I was determined to find out. I pushed the cover toward the foot of my bed and began moving my feet towards the door. As soon as my bare feet made contact with the cold hardwood, the scratching sound ceased altogether and was replaced with the violent shaking of the closet door. It let out an involuntary yelp, as it had been a long time since I'd heard that sound, and it had never seen it to be so violent. The closet doors were rattling around with such force that I was afraid that they would tear loose from their hinges. I lifted my feet back onto the bed and worked up the courage to begin yelling for my mother. "Mom! Mom, please come here!" I yelled with as much volume as I could muster. No response, not even the slightest break in her snoring. She was out cold. I yelled again and again, but to no avail. The moment I began yelling, the shaking of the closet doors had ceased, as they usually do in this situation. But my yelling wasn't followed by the sound of my mother's footsteps this time, and the doors began shaking once again. I didn't know what to do. I was far too scared to get up and make a mad dash from my mother's room, but my fearful screams seemed to have no effect. I began to sob. I'd reached a breaking point, and I couldn't help but pull my knees up to my chest and whimper. Suddenly, the doors quit their frantic dance. They just stopped shaking altogether. I managed to lift my face from the protection of my knees, and to my horror, I saw the closet doors begin to slide apart. No more scratching. No more rattling. I was finally going to come face to face with my tormentor. The doors finally opened all the way, and I could see now that my clothes and the darkness within were shifting. I could just make out a hand part the clothes on the rack and felt bile rise in my stomach as I realized the skin on that hand was absolutely putrid, gray and mottled, and I now became aware of the most horrific stench I'd ever encountered. I wanted to spring from my bed and through my window, or pull the cover over my head and will this nightmare away. But I was completely transfixed, rooted in place. I couldn't budge a muscle. I could now make out a torso in the space that my clothes had once occupied. It was covered in that same rotting flesh as the hand, of course. Next, and most terrifying, I could make out two pools of absolute darkness that constituted the eyes on this nightmare. They were sunk down deep in the sockets of its face and were completely void of any emotion I could discern. Just two black pits of emptiness. The creature finally emerged from behind my shirts and jackets hanging from my closet rack. It paused for a moment at the entrance of the closet and seemed to size up the room. It was tall and impossibly skinny, almost to the point of being emaciated. The fingers and toes ended in long, black, ragged nails, nails that were almost talon-like. Bits and pieces of flesh were missing over various parts of the creature's body. I could clearly make out what appeared to be ribs in its torso and the yellowing bone of one elbow. It had a few tufts of jet-black hair protruding from its grotesque and bulbous head. Its mouth was wide and filled with small rows of teeth that came to points so sharp they looked like they'd been filed. Its nose was two little slits with absolutely no protrusion that I could discern. It just stood in the doorway of my closet, smiling at me with those little sharp teeth and that unnaturally wide mouth. It stared at me as if it was trying to convey that it had all the time in the world and intended to drag out whatever horror was about to visit me. Suddenly, the creature jerked its head to the side and seemed to sniff the air with that horrible little nose. The sniffing became more frantic, and the creature kept jerking its head from side to side as if it had caught a scent it wasn't fond of and was trying to ascertain exactly where this odor was originating. That's when I noticed movement from my peripheral. I was able to tear my eyes away from this monstrosity long enough to look at the corner of my room where I'd seen the sudden movement. And there, standing just feet away from me, was that large, dark, ominous form. It seemed even more massive than it had in previous encounters, and it also seemed to be radiating an intense anger. To my amazement, this anger did not seem to be directed towards me, but at the creature now standing in front of my closet. The creature let out a hiss, and then a sound akin to a whimper, and took a step back when it noticed the large form standing in the corner of the room. I looked back at this dark figure, standing so very close now, and for the first time, I could make out distinguishing features. I realized that before this form had stood with its back to me on those nights, it had appeared in my room. Because now I could clearly make out a face that was covered in coarse red hair. I could now see that this figure was a very large man with pale white skin and a receding hairline. But the most noticeable feature were the intense grayish blue eyes that I could make out even in the darkness of my room. Those eyes left the monster in my closet for just a moment and made contact with my own. This great big man, standing in the center of my room, this great big man that I thought I would never see again, he smiled, then he winked at me, and with a burst of movement that my eyes could barely track, he dove into the beast, driving it back into the depths of my closet while the doors closed on both of them. I sat on the edge of my bed with tears in my eyes and my mind racing to process what it had just witnessed. I finally broke my stupor long enough to race to my mother's room and wake her. After a few moments of frantic shaking on my part, she finally swam to the surface of consciousness. When my face came into focus, she immediately sat up out of bed and took me in her arms. "What is this, sweetheart? What's going on?" At this point, I began to sob uncontrollably as she rocked me back and forth in her arms. I pulled myself together long enough to say, "He kept his promise. He said he would always be there for me, and he meant it." My mother tried to get me to explain, but I just continued to cry into her shoulder as she rocked me back and forth. At some point, I managed to fall asleep, with my mother whispering words of comfort until I drifted off. I never did hear another odd sound from my closet after that night, or any other part of the house for that matter. From that point forward, things returned to normal, and I felt as though a weight had been lifted off my shoulders. I'd received some form of closure from the events that took place that night. I also knew that no matter what obstacles I might face in the years ahead, I would always have someone looking over my shoulder, ever ready to fulfill a promise made to a small, sickly child. Thanks again to today's sponsors, Empty Faces and Audible, for their support of this show. Don't forget, as a listener, you can get 10% off your first box of mysteries with Empty Faces by using the promo code TOLD. Once more, just visit emptyfaces.com and enter the word TOLD, that's T-O-L-D, to let them know that Otis Gyrie sent you. What have you got to lose, except for maybe some sleep? But shit. Need sleep anyway. And if Empty Faces and their latest mystery hasn't satisfied your thirst for frightening fiction, don't forget, you can get a 100% free audiobook and get the chance to select two titles from a curated list of Audible originals when you try Audible for 30 days. Once again, visit audible.com/told or text TOLD to 500-500 to sign up today and let them know Otis Gyrie sent you. You won't regret it. Thanks for listening. You've been listening to Scary Stories Told in the Dark, a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights, and a proud member of the Simply Scary Podcasts Network. Visit simplyscarypodcast.com today to learn more about our network and our other amazing storytelling programs. Tonight's program was hosted and its featured stories performed by yours truly, Otis Gyrie. Selected stories have been adapted with the kind permission of their respective authors. Original music provided by Luke Hodgkinson and Jesse Cornett. Sound design and final mixing and mastering provided by executive producer and director Craig Groschen. Program's artwork and logo by David Romero. If you're looking for some fresh tales on a daily basis while waiting for the next podcast, check out my YouTube channel, the Otis Gyrie channel, and my extensive collection of narrated tales there. Simply search on YouTube by my name and you'll find me. And don't forget to subscribe and press the bell notification icon to get my latest releases. Got a scary tale of your own that you'd like performed? I take submissions. Email it to me today at otis@simplyscarypodcast.com to have your terrifying tome considered for production in a future episode of this show. That's otis@simplyscarypodcast.com. If you've enjoyed what you heard on tonight's program and are joining us on your favorite podcast app, subscribe to us to be sure you never miss an episode and leave a 5-star review and a comment. Your feedback means a lot to me. You can also follow Chilling Tales for Dark Nights and yours truly on Facebook to connect anytime and get the latest updates on this and other programs and my channel. If you're listening on the Chilling Tales for Dark Nights YouTube channel, do us a favor and hit the subscribe button and the bell notification icon for CTFDN as well to get more spooky tales from me and the crew and another episode of this program each and every Wednesday. And don't forget to hit that thumbs up button to tell us how we're doing and leave a kind word or a request. And don't forget to visit us at chillingtalesfordarknights.com and consider supporting the team by becoming a patron. In addition to helping us out, you'll get exclusive access to our audio archive and ad-free downloads of all your favorite stories, including those you've heard on this program. As for me, I'll be back next Wednesday with more terrifying tales to keep you up all night. But that's all right. Who needs sleep anyway?
Angie has made it easier than ever to connect with skilled professionals to get all your jobs projects done well. If you own a home, you know how much work it can take, whether it's everyday maintenance and repairs or making dream projects a reality. It can be hard just to know where to start, but now all you need to do is Angie that and find a skilled local pro who will deliver the quality and expertise you need. Angie has over 20 years of home service experience, and they've combined it with new tools to simplify the whole process. Bring them your project online or with the Angie app, answer a few questions, and Angie can handle the rest from start to finish or help you compare quotes from multiple pros and connect instantly, which means you can take care of just about any home project in just a few taps. Because when it comes to getting the most out of your home, you can do this when you Angie that. Download the free Angie mobile app today or visit Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I.com.